What Sally said, I would simply want to agree with, on the whole, not quite all the way. I think what I'd think about it immediately, just to tell you what philosophers are like, we're a very critical people, you know. When philosophers listen to a talk, they don't say, oh, that was good. They think, well, what's wrong with that? Well, there wasn't much wrong with it. There was nothing wrong with it. Okay, nothing wrong with it, Sally. But it was very Protestant. That's what struck me, just as a matter of interest, if you're going to align this on the sort of spectrum of world religions. It was a very Protestant presentation. Nothing wrong with that, but there are other views. And I'm talking about the philosophy of death. So I'm not confining myself to a particular strand of Christian thought, though I will speak as a Christian minister, or somehow I'll do that. I think one of the great books about the philosophy of death is Boethius, The Consolations of Philosophy. I think that's a must read. And the interesting thing about Boethius is he was always treated in the Christian tradition as a Christian, but actually he probably wasn't a Christian. He was probably a pagan. But he wasn't anti-Christian, at least. And one of his main consolations of philosophy is that dying is just like going to sleep. That every night we die, and we don't worry about it. We don't say, I might not wake up in the morning or something. I can't bear it, the thought of losing consciousness. Actually, we don't worry about it at all. And if you just thought, there'd be somebody else in the morning waking up, not me, you wouldn't worry about that very much, would you? Well, my wife might. But I think you'd have to say, for a great number of philosophers in the world, perhaps the majority of philosophers in the world, you will literally be a different person when you wake up the next morning. And so a key question here is what is meant by personal identity. That is the crucial question. What is it that makes you the same person from one time to another? Now, actually, this is a topic which would take years to explore, but we've all had years, haven't we? So we've all made our minds up in one way or another. But I'll just give a brief exposition of what I would call Buddhist, Hindu, and process theology thought on this question, which are all rather similar. I don't want to say they're all the same, but they're rather similar. And the similarity is this, that a human person, like us, consists of a series of experiences, thoughts, images, feelings, perceptions. And that series of experiences is not wholly continuous. I mean, there are breaks. When you go to sleep, there's a break. So it's a broken series, but there are some elements of these experiences in common. You have memories of of some experiences that occurred in the past, and you have projections into the future of what might happen, but it's the series which makes the person. So that's the point. That's what process theologians think. A person is a series of what Whitehead, the inventor of process theology or philosophy, called actual occasions, but you may say experiences. And that's what Buddhists think. It's what quite a lot of Christians think as well, but it's not any sort of official view. But what it would be saying is there's no continuing identical thing throughout your life. There is not a thing, which some people might call a soul, which stays the same throughout all your changing experiences. There's just the sequence of experiences themselves. So you are a sequence of experience. I'm not asking you to believe this, by the way. I'm just saying most philosophers probably think this, that you're a series of experiences. So if there's a break in that series, then what you have to say is not that your continuing, enduring, substantial soul is there, not having any experiences of it, and then it starts to have some more experiences. What you're saying is one series of experiences comes to a temporal end, and then a series starts again, but it's connected in some causal ways, with memories, for example, to a previous set of experiences. But, of course, if you go to science fiction films or you read science fiction books, you will know that this is a very, very variable process. Has anybody seen the film Total Recall? Perhaps you wouldn't watch films like that, I don't know. But I think it's a very interesting film. It stars Arnold Schwarzenegger, that well-known pacifist. I think in the film Total Recall, he only kills 2,000 people. So in the film, the whole point of the film is you don't have holidays anymore in the future. You go to a holiday shop, and you sit in the shop, and you're connected to brain implants and electrodes and things like that. And they give you memories of having had a wonderful holiday. And you don't have to do all the traveling to get there, right? And you have a great holiday. So this is an idea which is not totally ludicrous. You could implant false memories in people. And the whole point of the film, I won't tell you, that it's a very clever film by a man called Philip K. Dick, who is a really fantastic writer. He's dead, of course. So in this film, the story is, did he really do the things that he remembers doing, or did he just imagine them? And it becomes a very clever film playing with that idea. But the idea is, and lots of neuroscientists tell me they're seriously thinking about this, that they could, in principle, we can't do it now, you could in principle implant memories into people's brains, because you just have to get the neurons and get them activated in the right way, and then people will remember doing things. As a matter of fact, my wife tells me that I already do this. I remember things that I've never done. And I actually do remember doing things that she did. It's quite incredible. And that's probably because we've talked about it so often that I think I did it. And I say, well, I had a great time on the Isle of Wight, and she says, you've never been to the Isle of Wight. That was me. That's true. That happens. That happens to me, you know. And I think we all know people lose their memories too. And so with Alzheimer's, you get there, is this the same person? Well, one way of putting that would be to say, is it the same soul having all these experiences or having forgotten about them? Or is it just, is this sequence of experiences now disconnected from the ones that happened in the past? There is a slight difference about what it is to be a person. Now, Sally was very intriguing about this, I thought, and did, I think, imply, or even state, possibly, that there was no enduring substantial soul. Is that right?
Yes, sort of, yes.
More or less.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. But she didn't just say, you are nothing but a series of experiences. That's a slightly different view. But it's a view a lot of people take. If you were a Buddhist, that's what you'd believe. But I'll just say, by the way, if you think Buddhists think you are a person, the same person who gets reincarnated in the future, that is not what instructed Buddhists believe. Because instructed Buddhists believe there is no continuing substantial self. So you, the same substantial self, will never exist again. In fact, you don't exist now as the same person who came into this room. You're just a bundle of experiences which has certain causal connections with another bundle of experiences which you call coming into this room. But in fact, if I implanted some memories in your head, you would remember yourself as somebody else who came into this room who's now changed into you. Oh, well, it's getting a bit complicated, isn't it? But you can see how philosophers play with this idea quite a lot. There's a philosopher called Derek Parfit, who is well known for doing that and well respected among philosophers. So the personal identity comes down to the sorts of experiences that are continuously connected with each other by links of memory, personality type, and intentions for the future, plans for the future. Bodies are connected with this too. I mean, clearly, you think you have a body. But as Sally pointed out quite rightly, the bodies that we have change a lot in the course of our life. And we don't worry about that. Well, maybe you do, I don't know. But on the whole, you don't worry. You think, well, I used to be a little tiny baby, and I used to be a mature adult, and now I'm not sure. But anyway, the body is changing. And it happens slowly. But supposing it happened instantaneously, supposing you go to sleep one night and you wake up the next morning and you have aged 40 years, right? Well, you'd be disappointed, probably, but still you wouldn't say, I'm a different person now. Why not, right? What is the relation of your body, your physical body, to the actual experiences that you have? And would this sort of discontinuity that Sally talked about be worrying for you? There's a story by Kafka called Metamorphosis, in which a man turns into a beetle. Now, his wife didn't like that very much either, but he's a very large beetle. Is that possible? Well, no, it's not factually possible, but is it logically possible? Is it thinkable? Could you wake up with the body of a beetle? I guess you could. You know, philosophers are funny people. We spend our time imagining turning into beetles and all sorts of things. Now, this is connected with immortality. If the subject of today is what survives death, you may say, well, perhaps I, what I call the same person, could have quite a different physical body and it wouldn't matter very much. Would it? Now, I think Sally might say, oh, hang on. But I incline to say, I don't think it would matter at all. If I had the same memories, if I had the same sort of personality, that's getting difficult, but being irritable or interested in trains or something like that, and if I had the same general intentions, I'm in the middle of writing a book, I would like to get to the end of it, I remember what it was, I've got to make up what's coming next, I have it in my mind. If these things stayed the same, and I looked like a beetle, that wouldn't as such worry me. I'd just say, you know, get over it, my wife. This is the way I am now, okay? So, how important is the body? Now Sally mentioned a very good book by Paula Gooder called Body, which is a new book, and it's very good, really. My Bible study group is reading it at the moment. And she says that the body, the particular body you have, is very important. I think Sally implied that as well. I would question that. Is the particular body you have important? Well, you know what 1 Corinthians 15 says. I'm going to do it in Greek, just to show I'm a professor of theology. In Greek it says that the body that you now have is the soma, body, psychikon, right? Psychikon. It's like psyche, psychikon, which nobody can translate into English very well. It's not even very good Greek, really, but it sort of means mental body. That's what it means, psychikon. Mental body. Well, psychic, it's not really animal, is it?
Psyche.
Mind. Psyche means mind. Doesn't it? Psychological. Right, you see how you can have an argument? It is very difficult. If you read the most modern English translations, it will say something like physical body. Probably. I don't know. It'd be interesting to know what your translation said. But so just in Greek is soma psychikon. And now psyche is the word, I mean the book by Aristotle is called Peripsuche. He wrote that 400 years before Jesus, so he comes first. And Peripsuche is on the mind, on the nature of the mind. Or, for Aristotle, you could also translate that, here's another thing you could discuss for 24 hours, on the soul. And if you buy it in English, it'll probably be called on the soul. But if you do that, you've got to see that for Aristotle, the soul equals the mind. You've just got to say, people use these words in different ways. But if you're going to say, how did Aristotle use it? Soul equals mind. And that's the main Christian tradition. The main Christian tradition since the 13th century and before, but classically expanded by Thomas Aquinas in the 13th century, is that soul is the mind, and that's it. Okay. If you want to go into the Hebrew bit, which Sally did, really, the soul would become something like nephesh, which is the life force or the life energy of a body. But that's not the way it was used in classical Christian theology. Since Aquinas, right? This is where it's Catholic now, we would say, rather than Protestant, but it was the Christian tradition at that time when there weren't any Protestants. So the question that Aquinas would ask, for example, is, can the soul exist without the body? And for him that was a question, could you have mind or consciousness or experience without a physical body? And the answer for him was clearly, of course you can. Why not? No problem. Right, so that's a question you have to ask. Could you have a chain of conscious experiences without having a body? You can certainly imagine it. In fact, if we think about angels at all, we might think about angels as beings who have conscious experiences but don't have bodies. I don't know what you think about angels. What do Baptists think about angels? What Aquinas thought about angels was that they didn't have any bodies. And so they were disembodied minds. So what's a disembodied mind? That's a question. Well, it could be this chain of experiences. Clearly, you could have an experience of sitting in this room. This is the experience you're having. Here's a room, here's me speaking, you've got sounds, you've got sights, you've got smells, all these experiences. But couldn't you be having these without a body? So you look down and your body's disappeared. It's not there anymore, but you're still having the same sounds and sights and feels. Perfectly understandable, that, isn't it? You'd say, I've just disappeared. I mean, my body's gone. Other people would have a problem with that, but you wouldn't. Until you try to get up and walk out, of course. So I don't know how you'd manage that. But for a philosopher, this is not a problem. Like, you can have consciousness without a body. And for Aquinas, you can. Now, this is where Sally's view was Protestant. What about the dead? Saints. Now, Protestants don't ask prayers for their saints for their prayers. Catholics do. So, are Catholics asking? Technically, a Catholic would ask God to ask the saint to pray for them. My college in Oxford, Christ Church, has a lot of money from Henry VIII. On condition that the college prays for the soul of Henry VIII. What are we doing? We usually drink champagne, that's what we do. But what are we doing when we pray for the soul of Henry? Now, on one sort of Protestant view, there's nothing to pray for because there's nothing there. You die in death, it's like sleep. Those who sleep in Christ, and at the resurrection, whenever that might be, presumably in the future, you rise from the dead. So here's the bit Sally didn't go into. What happens between the time when you die and the time when you're resurrected? I've got no problem with resurrection. I'm suggesting that philosophers wouldn't have a problem because the body is not essential. A physical body is not essential to a chain of experiences. They are connected, nobody denies that. I mean, there are causal connections, everybody agrees with that. It's just a question of, couldn't this be the case, that you have consciousness but no body? Well, it could. The saints could be, there could be a state in which you don't have a body but you have a consciousness. And indeed, I suppose, for a Catholic, you do. But there aren't many saints, of course, and here's another Catholic bit. According to the Church of England, the doctrine of purgatory is a vain superstition fondly invented. Right. So probably we're not supposed to believe it. But what is purgatory? The word purgatory was first used in 1193 AD. That's the first use of the word purgatory. But the idea is much older than that. The idea of what some people call an intermediate state. And an intermediate state is the state between death and full resurrection. Now, here's where Christians begin to disagree. And if you're a real hardline Protestant, you say there's no such thing. There's no state between death and resurrection. But if you're a Catholic, however liberal, you'd probably say, well, there is. If you're an Anglican, you say, I'm not going to call it purgatory, because that's a vain superstition, so I'll call it something else. Right, the intermediate state, but there's a state. Would this be a state without a body? Well, it certainly wouldn't be this body, but then here's where we get into problems about what this body is. I mean, Sally, be very careful to say there are continuities and discontinuities. What I'm going to do is stress the discontinuity. It's much greater than Tom Wright thinks. Right. And it's greater because there's one basic physical law in our universe as we now have it. And it governs the whole nature of the universe. And without it, we wouldn't have time, we wouldn't have change, we wouldn't have progress. And it's the second law of thermodynamics, the law of entropy. And the law of entropy is actually essential to the way our universe is. And what it means is basically things get worse in the long run. All complicated integrated structures will decay, and there will be what used to be called the heat death of the universe. It will all run down. Something else might happen then, I don't know. But you couldn't have a universe like this. I mean, think of what the universe would be like without the law of entropy. It wouldn't have the same causal laws at all. And of course, we have to eat. We have to defecate. Do we do that with a resurrected body? Well, Thomas Aquinas raised this question. He said, are there lavatories in heaven? And his answer was, no, we wouldn't need lavatories because we wouldn't actually defecate. There you are, now you know. So he said, you would have intestines, but you wouldn't use them. Aquinas never shrank from a question. What size would your body be, he said. Well, it'd be reasonable size. You wouldn't be too fat. You wouldn't be too thin. You'd be just right. Okay. What age would you be? He knew the answer to that too. 33. You'd be 33. Why would you be 33? Well, that's when Jesus died. So obviously, that's a good age to be. So you'd be 33, average size, probably quite beautiful, you know. So you wouldn't obey the law of entropy, so you wouldn't get any older, nothing decays. So you wouldn't be living in a universe with these laws. And now this is what I want to say. That is not this universe. It's not this universe at all. So I think Tom Wright goes a little bit wrong when he tries to suggest that it would be this universe in which the resurrection occurred. I don't think that is, with our knowledge of modern science, I don't think we'd say that was possible. Doesn't mean to say that what happens in this universe is irrelevant. Doesn't mean that at all. It just means it will be a new, and I'm stressing the word, new creation. And it wouldn't have the sort of stars that we have, which work by decay and nuclear fusion. These processes wouldn't exist. They wouldn't exist because nuclear fusion is a very destructive force. It will destroy everything, including itself, eventually. So you wouldn't have anything that causes decay. So what would things be like? So I want to stress discontinuity. As a philosopher, right, I want to say, probably if you didn't have this law of entropy, there could be existence, but it would be very different. And since you could have consciousness without physical bodies, maybe it'd be as different as that. And lots of early Christians thought it would. Lots of early Christians thought, actually, the life of eternity will be life in eternity, beyond time. There won't even be change in it. It'll be entrance into a different form of existence. My favorite early Christian theologian, I think he was wrong, but he's still my favorite, Tertullian, said, what is the resurrection body like? And he said, it's a perfect sphere. Why? Because that's the perfect shape. So you'll all be totally spherical. And some of them, I shouldn't say this, but it's true. Some of my American students say to me, we're working on it. Anyway. Well, there had a lot of, there was a huge range of ideas in the early church. There were, you know, people didn't on the whole think the resurrection body would be anything like this. They would think, well, it'll be something completely different, and we can't imagine. And St. Paul himself says, we haven't any idea if you ask what the resurrection body is like. Well, I want to say it's not going to be like this at all, as far as we could make out. It couldn't be, because it's not going to be any of the laws of physics that govern what we are. So in a way you can't say, but why would it be a body? I mean, if you can have consciousness without a physical body, you might say, what's the importance of a body at all? And I think, as a philosopher, I need to mention René Descartes at this point, because he's the demon of Tom Wright. Dualism. Dualism is a word that everybody sneers at these days. If you're a dualist, you're really beyond the pale. You can't be a dualist. What on earth is a dualist? Well, a dualist is supposed to be somebody who thinks consciousness, mind, I'm using those words, they're obviously not synonyms, so I'm using them in the same way. Consciousness or mind and physical body are different, quite different in kind. And I agree with Descartes, I think he was absolutely right. The consciousness, that is to say, your perception of this room, is totally different in kind from the physical reality of this room and from the physical reality of the brain, which is connected with your consciousness. They're different things. I think I can prove this very quickly, which I will now do. You're sitting here, at least if you accept modern physics anyway, you're sitting here. What you see as you look around you are solid, three-dimensional, coloured bodies. Right, that's what you see, isn't it? And they're coloured, they have colour, lots of different colours. You ask a physicist, what is actually in this room, apart from your seeing it? Is it just like what we see? And the physicist would say, certainly not. I asked a world-renowned physics expert in my college, what would be there if nobody was looking at it? And he said, God knows. But he went on to say, well, what we think at the moment is you would have electromagnetic vibrations in 11-dimensional hyperspace. But you wouldn't have solid three-dimensional bodies. That's how it looks to us. It's not how it really is. So Bishop Berkeley, one of the most misunderstood philosophers of all time, was right. According to quantum physics, he was right. Looking at something changes the thing you're looking at. So the colours are just electromagnetic vibrations. We know that. And they're between infrared and ultraviolet. And we happen to turn those vibrations, which are waves, into colours. We do that. If we didn't have a brain, if we didn't have a mind, there wouldn't be any colours. There'd be electromagnetic vibrations. We could actually prove that. We prove it by a thing called the delayed choice double slit experiment in quantum physics. Take my word for it. Right. So most nuclear physicists would say there's no question about it, it's obviously true. What they disagree about is what is there when you're not looking at it. They all agree that it's not what we see when we look, that's an appearance of what is there. But they don't quite agree. The big disagreement is this, I won't go into it in detail, but is that some people think that the waves, they're actually probability waves, but anyway, the waves are real, and so the material world is an appearance of that. And other quantum physicists think, actually, no, it's the particles which are real, and the waves are mathematical abstractions. So they do disagree about this, but they all agree it's not solid objects in three-dimensional space. So I think modern physics shows, beyond a doubt, that the world, the physical world, is not what we actually see and feel and touch. So our seeings and feelings and touchings our mental experiences of the physical world as it appears to us, not as it really is. In fact, philosophers think about the view, the belief that the world is really the way we see it, as naive realism. It's naive because it's stupid. No physicist believes that the world, the physical world, as it actually exists, is what we see and feel and touch and move around in. No physicist believes that. That's a challenge to physicists. But they all agree with it. In fact, I say this because I get it from them. So we're not in a world where we know what the physical is. We know the appearances of what we call the physical world. That means I, as a philosopher, am much more skeptical about the body than some Christian theologians are, like Tom Wright, who think they know what the physical is and that that is what we essentially are. I'm saying the physical is an appearance of what we essentially are. That doesn't mean it's an illusion. It's an appearance. It's like an appearance would be, if you look at the moon on a dark night, it looks very small. It appears to be small. Actually, it's huge. So you say, what the moon actually is, it's huge, but it look, the appearance is that it's small. So our bodies are how the reality appear to us, but that's not actually how they are. Now, this raises intriguing possibilities. That what appears to us is perhaps not how things really are, and something might go wrong in the transmission from reality to appearance. In fact, it often does. People suffer illusions. That's one way in which they go wrong. People see oases in the desert when there aren't any. That's another way in which things can go wrong. But looking at the moon and seeing it as small, it's not, we don't call that going wrong, because we all agree that that's how it looks. So I wanted to say, dualism is obviously correct in some sense. Mental experiences are what we're immediately aware of, and they are different from physical reality, which we don't know anything about. Right? Now, the lesson of this, and this is where nuclear physics and quantum physics is really important for theology, the lesson of this is that the same consciousness could exist in different embodiments, different locations, in worlds which are not physical in the way this one is, but which form environments in which minds can gather information and communicate with one another. There might be lots of different ways in which this could happen. We obviously can't imagine many of them. We can imagine some of them. So I think that the resurrection world is very different from this physical world, and that this, what we call the physical world, is an appearance of something whose nature we know very little about. And even physicists now call that real physical world something like the veiled reality, reality under a veil. You don't even begin to understand it. And I think all physicists agree. One little fact which might intrigue you if you don't know it, modern physics depends upon two basic theories. The theory of relativity, we've all heard of that, E equals mc squared, etc. And quantum physics. We know that because our mobile phones depend on it and they work. And yet, I'm sorry to tell you that relativity physics and quantum physics contradict each other. They are absolutely contradictory. I've checked this out with all the physicists in Oxford. And I say, doesn't that worry you? And they say, no, that's all right. They're talking about different things, so it doesn't matter. If we tried to make either of these theories cover the whole of reality, it wouldn't work. There is no way that we can do that. We'd like to be able to, they say, but we can't do it. So what's the point of my bringing this in? Well, if we're talking about thought and faith, We've really got to think very hard about what thought tells you about the nature of the world we live in. And what I'm saying, I'm not contradicting anything that Sally said here. I'm just stressing discontinuity more and saying dualism is not really a dirty word. We are all dualists in the sense that we think consciousness, experience, is not the same thing as electrons bashing into one another or whatever's going on at the subatomic level. It's not the same thing. It's obviously not the same thing. They're connected, but they don't have to be connected. So that's what I want to say about things like total loss of memory in a human person. I want to say the memories are not lost. They are just inaccessible. They are physically inaccessible. Because the laws of this physical universe are such that, of course, if your brain doesn't operate properly, you don't access your conscious experiences. Just as when you're asleep, you don't access them. That's not a defect, that's just what happens. So, of course, the physical, what's going on in the brain, does affect your consciousness, but that's a contingent causal relationship. There are things in human consciousnesses and minds, subconsciousnesses, which never get expressed in the physical. We might call that disability. It's an inability to do what most human beings can do when they're functioning well, when their physical bits are working properly. Their physical bits aren't their mental bits. So I've got a more dualistic view. I might say, certainly I believe that the experiences a person has had in their lifetime and the form in which they exist is not accessible to anybody else. And in fact, it may become, for physical reasons, inaccessible and inexpressible to them. That doesn't mean they're not there. And because of time, I'll end by saying, look, the decisive factor for me is everything that we experience and think and do is known truly as it actually is in the mind of God, and it remains there forever. It's never lost. Nothing that we experience is ever lost. It's in the mind of God. And so I think eternal life is a life in which we get access to those bits of the mind of God which tell us what we really are, right? And also to other consciousnesses, which will be open to us, perhaps, in ways in which they're not now open to us. So what we shall be, we do not know, except that we will be as Christ is. And I think that's something slightly different from a very literalist, well, totally different, from a literal view of the resurrection of the body. You've got to say, it's not... You know, John Hick, a great friend of mine, but he used to say, you can think about the resurrection as if I disappear now, I just disappear, and I turn up in a lecture room in Australia, right? And so I've instantaneously transferred to another body. But it's the same sort of body in the same sort of universe. That's not going to work. I don't want to be in Australia. Right? That is not paradise for me. I want to be in some different state. But I want my consciousness to be accessible in a way that it's not now, and expressible in a way that it's not now, and relational in a way that it's not now, infinitely relational to everything in the mind of God in principle. And I think that's what resurrection life could be like. And so Jesus, the resurrection of Jesus, well, I want to say, that is the appearance in this physical form of a being whose reality is infinitely greater than anything we can imagine. A body with scars, that's how it appears. It's not an illusion. It's an appearance to us in this physical universe. But if we saw it as it really is, we couldn't even imagine it. And perhaps it would take us a very long time to come to a stage where we could confront it. And so, what happens beyond death? I will quote Gregory of Nyssa, fourth century Turkish theologian, and he said, eternal life is an infinite journey into God. That's what I think it is. Thank you.